go around and say hi, first of all, to Linda and Jeff, Franklin, Bob O, Mark, Coral, I mean Mark W, Coral, Carson, Bridget, Tyler, Sam, Joan, Jeff, Susan, Yeshe, Mark C, Gathel, Paul, Marvin, Shree, Shoketsu, Bob K, Jill, Doreen, Marcia, and Ruth Ann. Oh, all right. Let's see. In terms of announcements, let's see. Sunday, we will have a normal Sunday, but then in the afternoon, 2 p.m., we are having a Jukai outdoor, socially distanced Jukai, and only the Jukai preceptees and a couple guests apiece and then a few of us who are doing the ceremony can come because we can only have 25 people at total at our gathering. But I'm trying to work it out so that we will broadcast it via Zoom. I mean, it's going to be kind of a crapshoot because we're not using Wi-Fi. It's just going to be on like cell signal, but you know, it's worth a shot. So what I was brainstorming was that I would have my phone on the altar aimed at me. And then a couple other people will also be, you know, so they'll show up as like different Zoom views. And then other people who show up, you know, will be able to see. So if you wanted to just join us and witness, it is a kind of a nice opportunity to take the precepts again if you have taken them in the past. And if you are a preceptee, if you'll be taking the precepts this year, be sure to, I wrote you an email about it already, but be sure to send me your full name for your Jukai certificate.
How many are taking Jukai?
A total of 9.
That's great.
Yes, 2 people won't be able to make it to the in-person ceremony for COVID-related, you know, concerns, but I'm either going to do a separate online ceremony for them, or I will if they can hook up via Zoom and kind of participate on Sunday, that might work as well, and. And then the people who can't physically come to the ceremony, then Jinryu is going to hand deliver their wagesa and certificate for them. All right.
Just a suggestion. If you want, you can have like a separate feed for a YouTube streaming, just in case there's something wrong with Zoom. So you have at least 2 channels that's mm-hmm. capturing the thing. And that's also for free. So.
Good thinking. Nice to see you, Shree.
Very nice to see you.
Let's see. Did anybody want to? Shoketsu, did you want to say anything about awakening to whiteness, or do you feel like you're full at this point? You're still muted. You're still, yeah.
We're pretty full. We have 20 people signed up. Yay. Orientation, yeah, pretty exciting. Orientation is tomorrow night here on the Zoom. So we'll go through everything.
Okay.
And you can decide if you want to stay or not, those of you who signed up, and continue on through the 6 months. But for those of you who don't know, it's called Awakening to Whiteness, and it's a re-education how white supremacy is embedded in our culture, in our society, and ways that we can, first we have to realize it and then learn how to undo that, break it down.
Thank you.
Forward to it.
All right. Oh. So tonight, we're continuing with Uchiyama Roshi's How to Cook Your Life from the Zen Kitchen to Enlightenment. And we're on chapter 2, Concerning the Religious Life. So, I wanted to start off. You make several points in this chapter. And the first one that I'm going to start with, obvious from the title of the chapter, the Zazen of Dogen is religious in the very deepest sense. And the new title of the chapter, Concerning the Religious Life. So I want to talk a little bit about religion. So from the book on page 32, he says, the Tenzo Kyokun, the main essay that this book riffs off of by Dogen, the instructions to the cook. He says, the Tenzo Kyokun is a cookbook on life. Well, what is the basic ingredient with which we prepare this life? For Dogen Zenji, it was nothing other than Zazen. Religious life comes into existence by our asking how we can live with Zazen as the standard for our lives, while in turn being protected by Zazen. Looking at it from a slightly different angle, religious life becomes vital when Zazen begins to function in our everyday activities. Just how Zazen functions and guides us in a down-to-earth way is what this text is about. In this respect, the Zazen of Dogen Zenji is religious in the very deepest sense. It differs from that of any number of books on Zen flooding the markets today, which depict Zazen simply as a method to train the hara, or some sort of health plan, or as a method for cultivating the mind. Rather, Dogen Zenji's Zazen is religious in the sense that it teaches us most fundamentally how to live out our own lives. So I don't know how most of you feel about the word religion. I looked up and on, there's different ways to describe what we mean by religion or religious. Just for fun, I looked it up on Wikipedia, and I thought this is a decent definition that I will often quote to people, because when I'm explaining why I think Buddhism or Zen is a religion, you know, because many times people are like, oh, it's not a religion because we don't have a god or whatever, but so Wikipedia says, religion is a social cultural system of designated behaviors and practices, morals, worldviews, texts, sanctified places, prophecies, ethics, or organizations that relates humanity to supernatural, transcendental, or spiritual elements. However, there is no scholarly consensus over what precisely constitutes a religion. Different religions may or may not contain various elements ranging from the divine, sacred things, faith, a supernatural being or supernatural beings, or some sort of ultimacy or transcendence that will provide norms and power for the rest of life. So kind of like that. And so in a way, it's like that. Religion is this like it's a social cultural phenomenon. It's usually a collection of things that a bunch of people hold together provide some kind of meaning and guidance for their lives. And it's like, you can't really, you know, define it exactly, but you know it when you see it. So I'm going to quote a little bit from another of my favorite books. This is Why Religion Matters by Houston Smith. And he has a little section in here on how religion's kind of gotten a bad name. He points out during the Monica Lewinsky scandal that I guess Clinton said that he felt like in his affair with Lewinsky he had sinned, and Barbara Walters asked Monica Lewinsky if she thought she had sinned, and she said, "I'm not very religious, I'm more spiritual." So I think this is a pretty typical thing in our culture, right? I mean, there's many people who say, "I'm not religious, I'm just spiritual." So what does that really mean? Houston Smith says, "The answer points to a problem in our collective thinking about religion. A cloud has descended over the very word itself. Uncontaminated, religion is a noble word, deriving as it does from Latin religio, to rebind. The word targets what religion is essentially about. But because it challenges the prevailing scientific worldview, it has lost some of its respectability. Mention the word in public, and its sins are what jump first to mind. Still, it is difficult to argue that religion has nothing to be said for it. Then enter the word spirituality, to name without specification what is good about religion. Being no more than a human attribute, spirituality is not institutionalized, and this exempts it from the problems that inevitably attend institutions." But then he argues, and I think this is very interesting, that it's very weird and unhelpful to make spiritual into a noun, spirituality. He says, "It's a bad signal when spiritual, an adjective, gets turned into a noun, spirituality, for this has a dog chasing its own tail. Grammatically, spirit is the noun in question, and spiritual is its adjective. Spirituality is a neologism that has come into existence because spirit has no reference in science's world. And without grounding there, we are left unsure as to what the word denotes." But, of course, he explores in greater detail what, in a positive sense, he actually calls it, like, religious sense. So I'll see if any of these aspects of the religious sense you might relate to. So the religious sense recognizes instinctively that the ultimate questions human beings ask, what is the meaning of existence? Why are there pain and death? Why, in the end, is life worth living? What does reality consist of, and what is its object? These are the defining essence of our humanity. They are not just speculative imponderables that certain people of inquisitive bent get around to asking after they have attended to the serious business of working out strategies for survival. They are the determining substance of what makes human beings human. So the first part is the questions. And then the second, he says, the religious sense is visited sometimes by a desperate sense that we're very far from the answers, that the answers are very elusive, that truly knowing is so much bigger than our capabilities. But the third aspect of the religious sense, in a general way, is the conviction that questions have answers never wavers. And this keeps us from giving up on them. Though final answers are unattainable, we can advance toward them as we advance toward horizons that recede with our every step. And then the fourth aspect, he says, is we conduct our search together, collectively, in congregations, as scientists do in laboratories, and others do in professional societies. Today, our individualistic society comes close to assuming that religion is altogether an individual affair. But, of course, he says, and as we say in Buddhism, it's not. So, considering all these different kind of definitions, ways to look at religion, I'm curious about people's sense of whether you think of your relationship. Do you have a religious relationship with Zazen or with Buddhism or Zen? And what does that mean? I think as many of us have a little bit of a uneasy feeling around that for the reasons like Houston Smith talks about. You know, it arises like all the kind of negative aspects of religion. You know, there's many folks who come to Zen after negative experiences with other religions, right? Too much dogmatism or a lack of acceptance, etc. But in the to use more of the religious sense that Houston Smith's talking about, I guess it makes me think about how my teacher used to say that practice was about cultivating the habit of profound thought. That it was welcoming and turning toward those deeper questions, and starting to build the confidence that there are answers, and to help, to kind of orient our lives toward a continued exploration of those questions. So I figured we could do a short breakout and contemplate a sentence, one of the sentences that I read earlier on page, is it? Oh, I took my bookmark out. Page 32, which is religious life comes into existence by our asking how we can live with Zazen as the standard for our lives, while in turn being protected by Zazen. And I invite you to think about this as cultivating the habit of profound thought, and that there's really no right or wrong answers here. It's the wrestling with the words, the concepts, expression, the teaching, challenging our own minds, and not as an intellectual exercise, but as a way to explore and challenge the ideas we already have. So this is what I feel like essentially all Buddhist teachings are about. They're not about teaching you extra things that you should add to your base of knowledge, but that every one of them is asking you to examine and question assumptions or views, ideas that you already hold, but kind of unknowingly, without examination. So,
could I ask a question before we go out?
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering what existed at the time of Dogen in terms of the experience and or definition of spirituality and religion. And what's coming to mind are the Mapuche who are some indigenous people I spent some time with in Chile. They don't have a word for spirituality and religion. They can't even grasp the question of how do you experience or live your spiritual, it makes no sense to them because there's no difference. It's life is the practice. So they don't even have a language for those words, spirituality and religion. So I'm wondering what it was in Dogen's time.
I have to say, I have no idea. That's a very interesting question because it's true. Language forms our concepts, right? I don't know.
Yeah, and when you're spending time with these people, you see that really they don't have a need for the words religion or spirituality. You experience why those words do not exist for them.
Well, given that Confucianism and Hinduism were there before Buddhism, you can assume that that is what there was.
Well, I think it's going to be a very fascinating question. So I think hopefully every room there will be at least one person who has this sentence, religious life comes into existence. So how do we live with Zazen as the standard for our lives? And how are we protected by Zazen? And why? What makes that religious? It's a big question, I know, but if you want to just talk about, I don't know, maybe religion, and do you see your practice as religious? Why or why not? As an alternative question. Living with Zazen as the standard for our lives. I think I'm guessing that most of your breakout rooms were like mine, and it's pretty mixed reviews of the word religion. So hopefully we'll clarify a little bit tonight what Uchiyama Roshi means by that. So he says, what does it mean? What does it mean to live with Zazen as the standard for our lives? And what is it about Zazen that should be the standard for our lives as a whole, you know, I guess? Because technically, just sitting there, letting go of all thought, not doing anything, well, that's not really a directly applicable standard for the rest of our lives, which require action, activity, mental discrimination, etc. So it's not like, it's not a standard that we apply necessarily like literally. So what is it about Zazen that we are hoping to use as a standard for all of our activities? What is our attitude in Zazen? That's one aspect. When we are sitting, where is dukkha? When we are sitting, where is our selfishness? There's a saying that says, in Zazen, we keep the precepts perfectly. In Zazen, where is grasping? Where is aversion? Where is judgment? And what are we, at an even deeper level, what are we demonstrating through our Zazen? Through the doing of it, through the sitting down and doing Zazen. What are we enacting in the context of our lives? Not so much what are we doing as the like zazen as the activity itself, our conscious experience of what happens in our minds and bodies as we sit there. But with the by doing zazen, what are we demonstrating? What are we enacting? So I'll throw this one open for anybody has any thoughts. What are we? By taking that 20 minutes, that 25 minutes, that 30 minutes, and sitting still.
I think it's commitment of intention, really. You know, and there was somewhere else in the book where, you know, when you asked about sitting, you know, you sit for sitting's sake, and then you do other things with single-minded intention. So I think that's the relationship between zazen and how we live our lives, is this idea that, you know, you have a singular focus and an intention as you execute that focus.
I think of the Jinja Koan, and that, I think, trying to paraphrase it, I think Dogen talks about two ways of interacting with the world. One where you go forth and act on it, and the other where you are open and you are actualized by myriad things. And for me, zazen, like life, is not one or the other, but what we are, picking up on Franklin's point of intention, our intention is, I think, our practice, our attention is to open up to the myriad things, to study self by opening up to what's going on about us rather than an active way acting on the world and thereby creating ourselves as the dynamic force that. Yeah, it's being open. Being open and questioning.
Thank you.
I was thinking just a few words for me. Humility, respect, devotion, openness, and connection. Oh, and receiving.
I've been thinking for the last few weeks about zazen as nyoho sitting rather than nyoho sewing. And the way that it's just sitting down and relinquishing all strategies. And that maybe is a standard that can be applied to life.
I like the relinquishing strategies thing. I think that one thing that I really get out of zazen is just looking inward without bias and without attachments. It gives you a moment to look at things, not like it gives you the opportunity to step away and look at things without the bias, without the attachment, without the triggers and how you would usually react in the situation. And it leads to a lot of liberation because you're like, I don't know, maybe when you step away, you can see things without those triggers. And so it is a moment of releasing everything else and just like with a pure mindset.
I think, somebody said something.
Go ahead.
Okay. I think for me, Zazen, it allows me to breathe. And that helps me live life more calm and peaceful, which is what I want anyway. So, you know, forcing your body in that position and breathing allows you to chill. Then you're like, fuck the world. That's a great way of life, I think.
Thank you. Tyler, are you going to?
I think it's, especially since I was introduced to Shikin Tazen maybe just a month and a half ago. I don't even know how long it was. It's allowed me to kind of step away from the judgment. And I think if you can be like less judgmental of yourself and what your meditation is or should be or your thoughts or whatever you're going, if you can just be, it's okay, it is how it's supposed to be. If you can take that into the rest of your life with you, it's a really lovely thing to not be as judgmental on yourself or other people. I think it's been a kind of seeing things as less just as they are. I don't know if that makes sense. But.
Bob, Orda?
Yeah. You know, many years of doing Zazen, I think, has afforded me a great benefit in sort of isolating the experience somewhat in terms of being very mindful and being very aware. But at some point, I think without my actually doing anything about it, the separation between the rest of my life and Zazen begins to disappear, or there's no difference. The differences become less and less. And so everything that comes up in sort of both spheres, if I can put it that way, is just natural. And there's no need for me to put in some kind of a barrier between the two. It's just a complete welcoming of everything that comes up. That's life. It's our life. And so everything that happens in our life is something to be appreciated. And when that happens, there's something that goes on that I can't say it's happiness, but there's some kind of a settledness that comes into being that, and I would say it's kind of a happiness in a way, and, you know, or some kind of satisfaction that we have a continuous thread that we're running through all the time, whether we're sitting in Zazen or whether we're not.
Well, thanks. I love all of these observations, because I think that Zazen is profound and mysterious. because, I mean, if you interpret it really simply and it's just a form of meditation and you do it and you have this technique and you have this method and you try to let go and maybe it'll reduce some of your stress, sometimes you're good at it, sometimes you're not. You know, it's just a very utilitarian kind of approach, which there's some truth to that, right? I mean, like, you know, there's research that shows that, you know, meditation can reduce your blood pressure and all these kinds of things. But for me, it feels, I mean, I don't know if religious is the right word, but certainly, like Yeshe said, devotional. It ends up feeling like, even though my zazen is frequently, if I was just to evaluate it, is frequently not super. You know, it involves drowsiness. It involves wandering mind. It involves planning and thinking and whatever. But even though that can be the case, it's almost like what matters more is just that I'm doing it with this sincere attitude. What I'm trying to do, it's almost more important what I am trying to do than what I achieve, if that makes sense. And everybody's been touching on these things, like a sense of humility, a sense of putting down the strategies, of receptivity, of that being open, you know, that's beautiful. Like Mark said, the allowing the 10,000 things to come and experience themselves. And maybe we only do that for a second or two during our zazen, but there's something about enacting that intention, which is transformative. And I feel kind of religious. Ruth Ann, did you want to say something?
Oh, yes. I like words that start with R-E, again. So I see religion as to realign with what I want to embrace as sacred. Because sacred is just the simple that life keeps offering us all the time if we pay attention.
Well, now we'll throw out another question for us, which we can wrestle with. So he also has, we're protected by zazen. So religious life comes into existence by our asking how we can live with zazen as the standard for our lives, while in turn being protected by zazen. So what does this mean? Protected from what?
Yeah.
Protected from the bullshit of life.
Protected from ourselves, I think, in part.
Whatever we supports us.
Protected from delusion and ignorance, I hope.
I think over time it does give a protection. The more you practice, it seems to develop a confidence, an ability to cope, ability to be more aware of your own behavior and how it relates to precepts. So as you develop that skill and that awareness, it allows you to do behavior that you feel comfortable with.
And protection is, you know, it's something, it's protecting us from harm, presumably. Something that will harm us.
I see this in many different ways. Firstly, protect in the sense that the practice holds us, much like we hold each other in session. It gives you a base. Secondly, protects in the sense that the idea of you against the world, you of you needing protection, as you become more happy with your vulnerability, the idea of protection as a something you need drops away, and so you know, so that the world that you reside in is yourself. So what's there to be protected from? And then thirdly, I think the strain that's already been picked up, that going back again, stepping back, your emotions, your executive eye, your vulnerabilities can land you in deep shit sometimes. And, you know, to be just aware of yourself and how you interact is good medicine as well. And Zen gives you that. Yeah, so lots of, I look at protection there from in lots of different cuts, lots of different angles to it.
Thank you. Can you get closer to your microphone, maybe?
Practice builds an inner strength that protects us, builds a resiliency. Mm. So that we're, I don't know, I feel as a trade in the world as I used to. And so I started practicing.
Yeah, you're right. It's weird because you're like, there's not, what is there to protect, right? We're supposed to be kind of waking up to the fact that there's, we don't need protection, but I don't know, in a way that's its own kind of protection, right? I mean, I know that I, not nearly as often as I used to before practice, but still sometimes will find myself being pulled into a kind of despair, kind of overwhelm or negativity about life in general, like, oh, you know, just like, look at all the stuff that's going on. Oh my God, it's can be just kind of discouraging. And I know that if I sit more and if I practice more, if I cultivate my practice, that I will. Yeah, it's that resiliency. It's not a strength or a, it's not an oppositional kind of thing. It's just like, I don't know, something shifts, and it reminds me of the, I can't remember the exact phrase, but in the Prajnaparamita Sutras, it talks about the Bodhisattva has like stands firmly on no ground without a basis. There's no basis. And yet the Bodhisattva stands very, very strong and firm. So somehow it's like Zazen gives us that strength, but it's not a brittle strength. It's not dependent on anything. It's my experience. People are really jump in.
That kind of,
when you think about asana, sorry.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead, Sri.
I think when you think about Vipassana and its motivation.
Oh, you just muted yourself. There we go.
So I'm thinking about Vipassana and the extended Zazen version of it, which forces you to simply be comfortable with yourself and depend on yourself and give up the expectations of the world. And being able to depend on yourself is such a fabulous way to, you know, survive the ups and downs of life, because no matter what happens in life, no matter all that nonsense that you have zero control over, you can only depend on yourself. And having that realization come from meditation is super awesome.
Yeah, Shay, do you have something there too?
I was actually more tagging on with what you were saying, that for me, it's also cultivating relationship with bodhisattvas. And as that relationship develops and becomes, just as that relationship develops, you also have the protection and the strength and encouragement, guidance, love, whatever, of the bodhisattvas.
Hmm. Bob O?
Protection implies, or I infer from the word protection, that question that you started with, which is protection from what? And one of the things I am very good at, I think, is myself wanting to protect in a way, not in a good way, but in a way that lets me run away from things or indulge myself in things, and using that as a pseudo protective device. And altogether, I think I'm beginning to understand that we don't have to be protected. We actually, there's nothing to protect from, again, or whatever. And so I'm a little confused with that word, protect.
I kind of like what was a Gathel, protected from ourselves.
Yeah, that's kind of what it
came
down to for me.
Yeah, I feel protect is pro is for something. As Amy said earlier, I think life meets us halfway when we're open, and humans want to survive and thrive. So protect to go forward with what we give testament to. To go for it.
Thank you. Well, 9:00. I'll do a little closing verse here. We offer the merit of this practice to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time. All honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas. Wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. Thank you for being here, everybody. Have a good evening. Yeah. Or Mark, rest of your rest of your day.
Yeah. Good night, all.
Good night.